Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Around the world, people are fleeing death threats, persecution, prejudice, and violence. They often travel under grueling conditions to seek safety. This week at the San Francisco International Film Festival, a few of their stories are being told on the big screen. The film Midnight Traveler chronicles an Afghan family's 3,500-mile, three-year journey to Europe to flee the Taliban, which has issued a call for the father's death. The parents and their two daughters document their journey using cell phones. The film Unsettled follows the stories of several LGBT asylum seekers from Africa and the Middle East, fleeing violent bigotry and hate in their home countries, in some cases even from their own families. These refugee stories are far from over. Even after arriving to relative safety in Europe and San Francisco, nothing is certain. But with these films, we get a glimpse into their lives and their realities. To talk more about these films, today we are joined by Emily Madovian. Emily is the screenwriter, editor, and producer for the film Midnight Traveler. Midnight Traveler is screening as part of the International Film Festival, and if you're in the Bay Area, you can see the film tonight, or today, I should say, at 3 o'clock at the Creativity Theater in San Francisco, and then tomorrow at 5:30 at the Berkeley Art Museum Pacific Film Archive. And you can find more information about Midnight Traveler at yourcallradio.org. And Emily joins us in studio. Hi, Emily. Thank you for coming
Hi.
In.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Tom Shepard. Tom is director and producer of the film Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America. Unsettled is screening tonight at 8 o'clock at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Tom. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, thank you both so much for making these amazing films. I think what really stood out for me is how little we know about the refugee experience. Tom, what did you know about the experience before you embarked on this film?
Very little. I mean, I couldn't have told you what the difference between an asylum seeker and a refugee was. And this was around 2013, 2014, just at a time in the United States and in the West where LGBT rights were accelerating quite quickly. But at the same time, the atrocities in places, as you mentioned, in the Middle East and Africa were getting worse. So I think there was this sort of dissonance. And of course, as you know, San Francisco kind of has this, you know, narrative, ongoing narrative as being the Emerald City. And, you know, if you can come here as a sort of dislocated queer person, everything's going to be okay. This kind of happened to me 20 years ago. I moved to San Francisco. I was able to get a room in the Mission for $300, kind of find my tribe and, you know, kind of find my voice. So the question that the film started to look at is San Francisco still a place for people to be able to do that and for people who are fleeing intense persecution or need to kind of, you know, find a safe harbor, is San Francisco still that place in 2018, 2019?
Right. And it's so hard because it's so expensive. And we'll talk about some of the stories and the struggles to find housing. What about you, Emily? What did you know about the refugee experience before you made your film?
Well, I had written part of my dissertation on Tajikistan and on, in particular, the experience of social collapse during their civil war, which led to a lot of migration from Central Asia to Russia. But I didn't know a lot, like Tom was saying, about the kind of specifics of the current situation. I did know the family that I collaborated with in making the film already. So I was drawn into their case and their situation early on and before the film started. But I learned a lot, and as I think they did, because they also didn't know a lot about refugee experience until they were forced to migrate. So we were all learning about the law, the bureaucracy, the loopholes, and all the problems, you know, through their experience.
How did you meet Hassan and Fatima?
They fled first to Tajikistan. That's where the film begins. And I made my first film there, and I wrote my dissertation on Tajikistan. And I met them through a mutual friend. And I programmed one of his short films in Davis Feminist Film Festival, which I was director of at the time. And so I got to know them a bit that way.
And Tom, how did you meet the four LGBT asylum seekers in
unsettled?
So in 2014, I started doing some volunteer work with Jewish Family and Community Services of the East Bay. And that organization has decades and decades of experience with refugee resettlement. And they encouraged me. They knew I was a media maker, and we had spoken about the idea of a kind of longitudinal project, but felt very protective of their clients initially, rightfully so. So I just started working with, and some of them were LGBT folks. The United Nations and the State Department gave a fairly significant grant to Jewish families. So they were one of the first in the country to start resettling LGBT refugees, and therefore folks were starting to come to the Bay Area, and that's where I met our subjects. Yeah.
Well, but let's talk about both of your films, and then we'll talk about some of the similarities that all of these refugees go through. And if you have any questions for each other, please jump in. So let's, Tom, since we're talking about your film, Unsettled, let's just talk about this. In the very first scenes of Unsettled, we see people attacking and beating someone accused of being gay. In the film, Junior, who's from the Congo, says, "When you look so openly gay in Africa, you are 100% targeted." And then Subi, a Syrian refugee, says, "You'll be targeted from everyone, extremists or the government, even your family." And in the film, we learn that it's currently illegal to be gay, lesbian, or transgender in 70 countries around the globe. And in 4 of these countries, the punishment is death.
Yeah, I think when you've got state-sponsored homophobia in a country or a community, it gives permission to a number of groups, whether it's militias, whether it's ISIS, as you said, family members to really harm LGBT people, certainly excommunicate them, reject them, keep them in silence, but in many cases harm at the hands of their own family. So we, of course, part of the film is those traumatic backstories. And when folks arrive, they're carrying a lot of that trauma. But in some ways, the journey just begins. And what we found is that people continue to be dislocated. As a refugee, you have to leave your country and find a country of transit. You have to apply to the United Nations to get refugee status. And then you have to go through a very extreme vetting process, to use the words of our current president, that is extremely thorough and takes a long time. So the time between when you leave your country and actually begin to get resettled is often many, many months, if not years.
I was struck by what Melanie Nathan in the film said. She's an amazing woman, executive director of the African Human Rights Coalition, and she helps refugees in San Francisco. She said, quote, "I don't think Americans understand how hard it is to come here, even if you're white and you speak perfect English. It is mind-boggling how some people manage to do it."
Yeah, and this was the thing. When we started the project, there wasn't a huge infrastructure in the Bay Area to address the needs of LGBT refugees. And I think this is something we learned as well, that in this country, refugee resettlement is really predicated on families. So, you'll have a family maybe who flees a war-torn country, and if they come to the Bay Area, say they're an Iraqi family, there are immediate connector points. There are folks from diaspora who can maybe connect them to a mosque or a community center. So those folks have immediate kind of footholds into the community. If you're a gay Iraqi, it's quite possible that the last people that you want to see when you come to San Francisco are other Iraqis. So we found that LGBT refugees are at much higher risk of being isolated, of, not having support to deal with that trauma, let alone all the questions of getting a job, finding a place to live, mm-hmm. all those things. So it's there are a lot of complicated issues in this story.
And it's important to really look at what these people deal with in their home countries. Let's just talk for a minute about Junior. He's a refugee from Congo, born into a Christian conservative family. His mom is a pastor. And he says, for his own mother, gay people must be put to death. Quote, "My life for her is a disgrace. In Congo, they say gay people do not exist. This is not African culture."
Yeah. There's this way that it's culturally reinforced to basically reject homosexuality, and that reaches so deep. And I mean, family is supposed to be sort of the safe place we go, and this is always a conundrum for queer people, historically also in this country, is that the very people that you would go to for safe harbor are the ones that you actually have to flee from in this story. In Africa, you have, unfortunately, a common instance of what's called lesbian corrective rape. So you have men where it's acceptable, it's culturally acceptable to...
And I just want to say this could be a little disturbing for people, especially if you have kids in the car.
Yeah.
Thank you
for mentioning that. Yeah. Just that, you know, men will essentially rape women acceptably as a way to, quote, put them on the straight path. We can talk about it a little bit later, but in our film, we follow a lesbian couple from Angola, from Luanda in Angola. Mm-hmm. It's very, very rare for women to be able to flee many of these countries and many of these situations. They often have to get permission from their fathers or brothers or husbands. And so for these women to not only kind of cultivate this love relationship, but then have the wherewithal to be able to get out and start new lives in the West was nothing short of remarkable, really.
Cheyenne and Mary, they talk about how difficult it was in Angola to even leave their home. And then Mary says, people don't understand how hard it is to be a refugee. It's even harder when you're coming from Africa because they think you're coming from the bushes. So it's interesting when you think about refugees of color, black refugees from Africa, and what they face versus white refugees, like a white refugee, for example, from Syria. I mean, not white, but you know what I'm saying. If you were to just put them on the street, you'd think white and black. So there's a whole other layer for refugees of color.
That's absolutely true. So, and also because they're actually asylum seekers, they're coming and their status is precarious. So if you come as a refugee mandated by the United Nations, you get here and you do have a refugee benefit. It's not much, $350 a month. So that's not going to get you very far in the Bay Area for 8 months. But in the case of Cheyenne and Maria, as you were saying, they were asylum seekers. So they got a student visa and were able to cross the border. But then they had to like find a pro bono attorney to file a claim. They weren't allowed to work for a number of months to get a work permit. So the hurdles are really enormous in this story. Yeah.
And we talked briefly about trying to get housing in the very expensive Bay Area. Junior, the refugee from Congo, just talks about how difficult it is. He moved 10 times in his first year in San Francisco and says it's like you're still migrating, you're still traveling. And one of the scenes that really got me with Junior was when he qualified for a temporary spot in a transitional home, and he's told, quote, for safety, don't go that way, don't go through those projects. And he kind of just looks at the guy like, okay. You know, they don't – I mean, I think they're – tell me if this is the case, that they're shocked about what they find in San Francisco.
Yeah, I feel like we've learned a lot from Junior, who in those first months really exposed kind of the lack of infrastructure. And the Bay Area, there's no dearth of nonprofits. There's no dearth of really well-intentioned people. There's also a lot of legal resources. As I was saying before, in the asylum cases, there are plenty of lawyers that are interested and want to step forward. But on the humanitarian side, in terms of basic housing, in terms of, you know, jobs for folks who are coming with very little resources, Junior really exposed all of the sort of gaps in what might be needed. And that's something that we hope the film might be an occasion for folks to say, oh, my goodness, we still have some ways to go here.
We also learn in the film that since World War II, the United States has resettled more refugees and asylum seekers than any other country. During the Obama years, LGBT asylum claims began to rise, but since 2016, the number of refugees the U.S. is accepting has been cut by a whopping 70%.
Yeah, we were just talking last night. We had our first premiere in the Mission in San Francisco, and you know, every one of us in this project on both sides of the camera assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to be the president and would kind of carry the banner forward of Barack Obama, who had increased the cap on refugees, increased the number of refugees per year that were allowed into the U.S. Well, of course, Donald Trump ran on a platform that was, you know, very anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, and has really followed through with that in his first year, cut the number of refugees in half. In the second year of his administration, did the exact same thing. So at this point in time, we're down 70% in terms of the numbers of refugees at a time when the refugee crisis has never been worse. There are some really deep fundamental questions about what kind of leadership is the U.S. going to provide on this front. So,
Tom Shepard is director and producer of the film Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America. It follows the stories of several LGBT asylum seekers from Africa and the Middle East who are fleeing violent bigotry and hate in their own countries, in some cases from their own families. And if you are in the Bay Area, I hope you can see the film. It is tonight at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, and you will be there along with, is it everyone in the film?
Everyone in the film, wow, and everyone who helped make the film is going to be there tonight. We'd love for people to come out and see it.
That's going to be amazing because yeah. All of the refugees in this film end up in San Francisco. And so I hope you can see that film if you're free tonight, 8 o'clock at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. And for people who live outside of the area, how can they eventually see your film?
Yeah, so the film was funded by a group called the Independent Television Service, ITVS. They're our co-producer and funder, along with a lot of other grant, you know, foundations locally. But because of that, we will have a broadcast on PBS, and we don't know when that's going to be slotted, but we guess, you know, in the next 9 to 12 to 14 months, and we'll definitely be putting that out as we continue to try and bring the film to festivals and community screenings. We'll let people know when that broadcast is.
That's great. Yeah. We're also joined today by Emily Madovian. She is screenwriter, producer, and editor of Midnight Traveler, and that film chronicles an Afghan's family's 3,500-mile, three-year journey to Europe to flee the Taliban, which issued a call for the father's death. The parents and their two daughters document their journey using cell phones. And we're going to talk now with Emily about Midnight Traveler. But if you have any questions for our guest today, we'd love to hear from you. We do a lot of shows about refugees, but really digging down and hearing about their stories gives you a completely different perspective than the soundbite you might get in the media, and definitely what you hear from most politicians. So if you have any questions, we'd love to hear from you. If you have seen any films about refugees, if you're a refugee and you'd like to talk about the experience, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. So, Emily, you said that you met the family in Tajikistan. Tell us about Hassan Fazili, and then you can tell us about Fatima Husseini.
Yeah, so Hassan and Fatima are both artists, both filmmakers. So in Afghanistan, he was making short films. He was directing, writing television serials. So, you know, popular things that people, you know, in the community would know if they watch TV. She was an actress on television, which is quite a bold thing to do, coming from the background that she came from. She was raised illiterate, and her father cut her off as a consequence of the choices that she made. But obviously, they supported each other in the choices that they were making as a family. So he was a working professional, you know, in theater, film, television, and he got a commission, basically. Just it was a work-for-hire project. It was not a passion piece. It was not his own idea. That came from the Peace Commission, which is sort of an internationally funded commission to try to build peace in Afghanistan, to make a film about Taliban commanders who laid down arms and chose peace. And that film aired on Afghan national television. After it aired, the Taliban assassinated the kind of primary subject in the film, the most prominent subject in the film, who was a former Taliban commander. And then he found out that they had also put out basically a hit on him.
Tell us also about the cafe that he opened.
Yeah, so this is, you know, because artists are always interested in more than one thing. He and some friends had also opened a cafe called Art Cafe, which was incredibly beautiful space, lush gardens, and they would hold music and poetry gatherings, and men and women could come and sit at the same table and have tea, which is incidentally completely legal, but it was so socially upsetting to some people, including people who were, you know, in the police force, that that also raised the ire of the Taliban against him.
Then he talks about meeting someone at a wedding in Iran, Hussein, we'll just call him. They become close friends. Hussein joins the Taliban and tells him that his life is at risk. And he says that if he hadn't told him, he probably would have been kidnapped.
For sure. Yeah. That's the way that it works, right, is that they control roads, they control your motion, they kidnap people, and then they assassinate the people who are on that list and maybe more. And so this was a 20-year friendship. It was a very deep, very close friendship. And this friend, late in their life, had decided to join the Taliban. And I think it's one of the kind of testaments to the value of friendships across political divides, that they didn't sever their friendship. So he joined the Taliban. Fazali was very clear that he didn't agree with that choice, but they remained friends. And as a consequence of that, he got the phone call that said, "I see your name on this list and you need to flee," which is an incredible thing to do. And that friend, incidentally, died about 18 months later in prison without a trial after being captured by the other side. So it's never a simple story, right?
Fazali also talks about his family. He was born into a very, very conservative family, and he says he's the only one who's not hardline conservative. Is that right?
He's the only one who's not a mullah. They're conservative. And it's quite strange to them that he chose to be an artist.
Mm-hmm. So initially, in March 2015, the Taliban put a call out for his life. He and his family fled to Tajikistan seeking protection. After 14 months of asylum applications, no country agreed to take them.
Yeah, and this is the other half of the story that Tom was telling, and you were saying, you know, the difference between the asylum and the refugee system. Mm-hmm. So here's where we see how that breaks down for some people. Tajikistan had passed laws that they would not allow anyone who fled to their country to be resettled to a third country, and they had passed all kinds of very common, actually, anti-refugee laws: no right to work, no right to live inside the city, all kinds of things like that. And what that meant was they were blockaded from accessing the refugee system. So even though UNHCR does have an office inside Tajikistan, the only support they would give them was in helping them get an exit visa so that they could be deported to Afghanistan with a visa, as opposed to basically having overstayed a visa. They couldn't provide any kind of resettlement services. They couldn't provide them with access to the world system. So they put in all these applications, and they would receive responses that would say, "We don't accept refugees unless they've been certified by the UN High Commission on Refugees." Well, the UN High Commission on Refugees doesn't functionally operate inside Tajikistan. So what the result of that is that people who have legitimate claims and who have done the legal, reasonable thing, which is to flee to the closest nearby country, are forced onto this extremely dangerous migrant route in order to access the asylum system instead of the refugee system.
Mm. And so they have no – this is the other thing that really stood out for me, is if they want to flee a situation like this family trying to flee the Taliban, they have no choice but to take this dangerous and uncertain migrant route. That's the only way they can get out.
Right. Because they can't get anywhere where they can get access to refugee services. So they have to get somewhere that will listen to their asylum case fairly. And they bring the identical case that they had the whole time on their journey with them to Europe. And when they get there, it's ruled that it's legitimate. But that multi-year, very traumatic experience that the whole family, including their daughters, went through was necessitated just by these gaps between the refugee and the asylum system.
And after the break, we will talk about the, as you said, very scary, horrific, uncertain journey that they went on, sleeping in the forest, sleeping in the rain, just not knowing what a certain camp would be like, walking for days. We'll talk more with Emily Madovian after a break. She's screenwriter and producer for the film Midnight Traveler. It chronicles an Afghan's family 3,500-mile, three-year journey to Europe to flee the Taliban. The parents and the two daughters, which are so sweet, they document their journey using cell phones. So you just see these very intimate moments that this family has on this journey. And if you are in the Bay Area, you can see Midnight Traveler today, 3 o'clock at the Creativity Theater in San Francisco, and then tomorrow night at 5:30 at the Berkeley Art Museum Pacific Film Archive. Find more information, yourcallradio.org. Same question to you, Emily, for listeners outside of the area. How can they see your film?
So we have distribution in the U.S. through Oscilloscope that will release it theatrically this fall. So if you're in a larger city, there's a likelihood it'll come to you then.
Great.
And then we also have ITVS funding, and we'll be on public television next year.
Great. I'm so glad to hear that. We're also joined by Tom Shepard. He is director and producer of Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America. It follows the stories of several LGBT asylum seekers from Africa and the Middle East fleeing bigotry and hate in their countries and in some cases from their own families. And Unsettled is screening tonight at 8 o'clock at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. Tom will be there, everybody who worked on the film, and 4 of the LGBT asylum seekers will be there. And I hope you can go. That'll be a really special event. That film also will eventually be broadcast on PBS. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with filmmakers who tell stories about refugees, and we'd love to hear from you. We're talking about 2 films that chronicle the stories of people seeking asylum and fleeing violence. If anyone in your family or if you have been forced to flee your home country and seek asylum, we'd love to hear from you. What was your experience like? And if you work with refugees and asylum seekers, what resources are available? What resources are most needed? And there are lots of misconceptions out there. So if you'd like to talk about those, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are joined by Tom Shepard, director and producer of Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America. It focuses on LGBT asylum seekers from Africa and the Middle East. If you're free tonight and you're in the Oakland area, you can see the film at 8 o'clock at the Grand Lake Theater. It'll also be on PBS eventually. Emily Madovian is screenwriter, editor, and producer of Midnight Traveler. This film chronicles an Afghan family's 3,500-mile, 3-year journey to Europe. The whole family documents their journey using a cell phone. And you can see Midnight Traveler today at 3 at the Creativity Theater in San Francisco, tomorrow night, 5:30 p.m. at the Berkeley Art Museum. And this film will also be released this fall on PBS. So hearing you both talk about your films, what are your thoughts just about the power of film to tell this story and really take on a lot of the misconceptions and the stereotypes about refugees, especially the ones we're hearing really horrific statements from this administration?
I think, as you were saying at the top of the show, most Americans don't know this story. I think are fed a lot of news coverage about refugees and certainly about the Syrian refugee crisis. But I think very few people have actually met them. And so there's something about this medium that in a fairly non-threatening way, I think, is almost a placeholder. It allows people to connect in a really deep way, sort of through the heart. And then I think people start to have a lot more questions and then we'll want to ask, okay, what resources are available? Could I actually be a refugee volunteer or a refugee host? You know, I think there's a way that the conversation can start on a very visceral and emotional level, and then that can certainly lead to kind of increased information.
And how can people volunteer? Because in the film, we meet a lot of people around the Bay Area who either offer rooms, drives, legal help.
So some of the groups that are doing that kind of hands-on work include the Unitarian Church of San Francisco. They have a group called the Guardian Group and partnered with Jewish Family and Community Services to provide some immediate needs to look for housing hosts for some of the LGBT refugees that were coming. Also, Melanie Nathan's group that you talked about, Africa HRC, she's working specifically with LGBT refugees and asylum seekers coming from Africa. I think also, I mean, it's interesting in this story, especially as we get the film out of San Francisco, a lot of the refugee resettlement work has been done by groups who have strong religious affiliations. And some of those groups are pretty progressive. So you have Quakers and Unitarians and Jews. And some of them are more conservative and their record on gay rights is a little more spotty. So we're wondering, again, you're asking about the power of film. Will Unsettled be maybe an occasion to kind of bring some of these groups together? People who have, you know, years and decades of experience doing refugee resettlement work who are now going to be asked to kind of look at the unique needs of LGBT people who are coming. So in terms of some kind of alliance building, we hope that the film might catalyze that a little bit. Yeah.
And that's interesting because I almost felt like they were fleeing persecution because they are LGBT. But once they got here, it really didn't have anything to do with San Francisco per se, although it obviously is safe for most, although some of them did still deal with just a lot of problems on the streets. Mm-hmm. But it was the financial mm-hmm. issue that was so hard and also the legal issue that mm-hmm. was so difficult.
Yeah. And that reminds me, too, on the legal side, there's a really great referral organization called LCCR, which is Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. And in the film, we have a scene where Cheyenne and Marie go with Melanie Nathan to try and, like, how can we get a pro bono attorney researcher in that process? And they actually work with lawyers in the Bay Area who don't have to necessarily have backgrounds in immigration law, but who might want to spend some pro bono time helping an asylum seeker. In that case, it might actually help someone's life. So that's another great resource for folks.
And the other thing is that the isolation is also what really struck me is Junior especially talking about just how he feels alone. Not, you know, we don't have friends like you do to talk about our everyday problems. We know they left their families. I mean, and obviously anyone who leaves their country and their family, they want to be with their family. I mean, they said even though they completely, you know, say that they don't be, you know, they say horrible things about LGBT people, we still love them. They're our family. So is there other opportunities to maybe be like mentors or take people to lunch?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yesterday, as part of SF Film Schools Project, we showed the film to a group of high school students in the Bay Area. And the subjects in our film are roughly in their mid-20s. They fled their countries in their early to mid-20s. And a lot of those young people were like, can I meet them? You know, and I think just to befriend a refugee or an asylum seeker and get over some of the stereotypes you were talking about earlier. You know, Marie says, like, people think because we're asylum seekers, we're criminals or we're here to, like, take Americans' jobs or, you know. So I think just to be willing to maybe get out of your comfort zone and connect and say, hey, I'd like to meet you, the folks would love that. And again, through the organizations that we've talked about, that would be a great way to connect.
And Subi, the LGBT refugee from Syria, says that he's struggling with depression, even though Subi ends up kind of becoming this superstar because he testifies in front of the UN, in front of Congress. All of these media outlets do videos of him. He finds a job. He finds an apartment. He has partners. But he still says it can be very lonely. He misses his family.
This is a really interesting story. It wasn't 7 or 8 weeks that he'd been in the U.S., and he was invited by then Ambassador Samantha Power to come and testify before the Security Council of the United Nations. He was the first openly gay person to do that for the Security Council. So his story went from, you know, landing in the Bay Area and beginning to resettle as a refugee to becoming basically a poster boy for refugee rights. And he started getting hundreds and hundreds of emails. He was on NPR. He went and testified in Congress. So I think one of the things, since we were filming before, during, and after that, was the question of, like, you know, certainly what is the incredible service of being able to do that, but what are the costs of becoming, you know, of getting in the limelight, especially when you've, you know, your strategy for survival your whole life has been to be quiet and to keep that down. So it is an interesting story, and I think Subi, when he talks about it, says, you know, it's been really hard. And when then he hears stories of people who haven't been able to get out, he sometimes feels really helpless, and there's, you know, it's pretty complicated.
Mm. Tom Shepard talking about the film he directed and produced called Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America. What about you, Emily? What are your thoughts about the power of film and what it can do to raise awareness about these stories?
Well, as we were saying before the air, I live in rural, very rural America. And so, you know, when I'm editing, I often think about my neighbors and my people who live around me and try to avoid using buzzwords or things that would really just trigger an in-crowd on one political side or another. Because I think that at the human level, these experiences are very relatable. The idea of somebody, being in danger and wanting to protect themselves or protect their children, I think most people see that as a kind of basic human impulse. So what we were doing, and I think we were very fortunate that we had an extremely charming family with two adorable little girls, and who were willing to be extremely open in self-documenting and kind of open up every aspect of their life over a long period of time. What that meant was we could focus on telling one family's story longitudinally, allowing us to have moments of joy and humor with them and kind of feel that we were in this family. And then we were just very careful with the little bit that we gave that was contextual to not tie it to anything that we thought would kind of trigger people to frame this according to prejudgments that they came in with. We're really just asking people to imagine themselves for 87 minutes into this family's shoes with them. I guess that's why we're filmmakers. I do believe that can be very powerful because it gets behind language like illegal immigration to ask, isn't there something that seems fundamentally moral if you've done the legal thing, you've done every legal thing, and every door has been closed to you, and in the end, your case is ruled legal. So these notions like illegal are, I think, incredibly reductive, and they go a long way towards closing us to hearing people's stories.
Where do you live?
I live in Idaho.
And have you shown the film in Idaho?
No, not yet. I'm looking forward to. I have a few friends who've seen it, but mm-hmm. We haven't done public screenings yet because mm-hmm. we're still in the festival circuit. And unfortunately, rural Idaho is not the center of the festival circuit.
Right. We'd love to know what the reaction is when you screen it.
No, I'm just appreciating, given the sort of toxicity in the national discourse right now and how leaders are, dividing by sort of playing to and pandering to fear and division, like what you're talking about in terms mm-hmm. of being able to kind of open those doors to conversation, because these films inherently are not political. They're personal. Mm-hmm. They're personal stories. Of course they have political dimensions, but
right.
That's pretty powerful what you're saying. Yeah.
Well, and the reality is it's rare unless, depending on where you're from, what circles you run in, a lot of people don't know Afghans, for example. They see the news, they get the headlines, and it's usually about war, bombing, Taliban.
Yeah.
And they don't see this side.
Right. And there's a lot of what we don't see has to do with certain norms about what is and isn't said in public. And that's one of the ways that I think this family is very remarkable in their openness, because it allows us to see that, for instance, Afghan women are very feisty and very strong, that many people who are nominally Muslim are non-practicing, the notion of a non-practicing Muslim, I think, for a lot of Americans is kind of foreign because Islam itself has become so politicized. But of course, there's tons of non-practicing Muslims. It's just like an Easter and Christmas Catholic, right? There's a lot of people who sit in a much more subtle place on these spectrums. And by being willing to give us much more than the soundbite about themselves, they're very vulnerable. And I'm sensitive to trying to protect them from that. But
right.
but I think that what they've done has allowed us to see them in a much more rich human light.
So they filmed themselves in this journey on cell phones. And what was the process like? Because when I saw them, what I loved was when, let's say, for example, Hassan, the father, was filming his daughter, is it Nargis?
Mm-hmm.
Then Fatima was filming her husband, filming the daughter. And it was just really amazing video. How did they get that footage to you over the course of these 4 years?
I found contacts in the countries they were going through to meet them. So they were filming on phones that accept memory cards, so you can swap out the footage. So it doesn't have to be just what fits on your phone. So they would have a stack of these. A contact would meet them, and that contact would come with a laptop and a drive, and copy everything to the drive, and then mail it to me in the U.S. to back it all up, make sure everything was safe.
Wow.
And then they would wipe their cards and keep shooting, because he didn't even have a laptop as they were traveling. It would have been heavy and unsafe. It, would have been damaged for sure to carry it. But the sort of showing them filming. I mean, it was also that was part of who they are, you know, that they're filmmakers and this is how they know how to respond to the situation that they're in. You know, they're very bored, you know, like speaking of like basic needs, you know, or loneliness, like they're in a room for years waiting for somebody. They literally have nothing to do. Well, they're filmmakers. What are they going to do? They're going to make material from what's around them. So, you know, we didn't want to hide the filmmaking because it was part of who they are. And it was part of the problem they were encountering was that the lack of work, right? They were both very busy people before. They didn't know what to do with themselves in an 8x10 room with nothing to do.
How many hours of footage did you receive?
Hundreds. Hundreds.
I bet.
A lot.
So you told us about Hassan. Tell us about Fatima Husseini.
She's lovely. She's a very feisty person. She's a very... I think she's a kind of an ever-evolving person. I think this is part of what I find interesting about her. When they married, she was illiterate. Then she, you know, learned to read and finished high school. You know, it was in high school while she had a daughter, you know, because it was important to them. Then started acting. And, you know, I've known them for a few years now, and what I see about her that I really like is, aside from the kind of pragmatism and hope and determination to get through something like this and make things okay for her daughters and, you know, kind of be a good protector and mother in this ridiculous situation, is also that she has this kind of openness and she's always kind of evolving according to what she's learning around her. Mm-hmm. And they've seen incredible things, you know, in the course of this journey that nobody really should have to digest. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't just close herself to it and become antagonistic. Even after, you know, they were attacked by neo-Nazis, they're always, both of them, very, very careful to be clear that it's not representative of all the people in that country and that there were very nice people there, too. So they don't do that kind of black and white generalization about other people, which is a nice model for how we could...
That was pretty powerful. That happened in Bulgaria, right?
Yeah.
They were just shopping out one night, and these white nationalists started yelling at them and then threw rocks, and one man with them was bleeding. He tried to, was it hit one of the little girls?
One of them tried to punch their older daughter in the head, right. And and Hassan put his arms around her, so he punched him in the arm instead. That was a very, very hard thing, though. She was 9 years old. The idea of a grown man wanting to punch a 9-year-old, and this is a very articulate, very smart 9-year-old. So she talks about it and how frightening it was. And for her, part of what was so upsetting was that this man punched her dad, mm-hmm. you know, who was just protecting her.
Since you talked about the Nargis and Zahra, her sister, the role that they play is pretty amazing. I mean, we're seeing them just do what kids do. Sometimes they're bored. Sometimes they're dancing to Michael Jackson. But as you said, we hear Nargis also telling her own perspective, just talking about how difficult it is, how she wants to forget this whole experience. And you kind of have to remind yourself, this. She's 9?
She's 8 at the beginning, and she's 11 now.
Wow.
Yeah, she's a very, very, very articulate, very smart girl. And she's right at that age where she understands everything going on around her. No one carries her through the woods, right? She walks when they walk. And she understands the context that they're in and the dangers that they face in a way that sometimes her younger sister doesn't. So she also speaks in a much more unfiltered way because she's not thinking about how it's going to be received in some political context. So what you get from her is this direct kind of childlike perspective. And so we made a point in the film to try to weave as many of those moments as we could in, because she's also filming and there's a lot of adorable moments that I found where she was alone with the phone, kind of just playing. And so I wanted us to experience what it was like to be an 8-year-old on this journey who had a phone as a toy and was kind of interacting with the world through it. And not just, again, not just have her be a victim, because a big part of what we got from letting them tell their own story was that they're people who are having fun experiences too. So she sees the ocean for the first time in the film, for instance.
I love that part.
Because, you know, they come from a landlocked country.
Right.
And, like, you know, that's a beautiful moment, you know, in spite of the circumstances. We wanted to have that because that's what makes us all human, is that it's a very rich, diverse experience. It's not just harrowing every day.
Well, that's what's so amazing about it is, you know, you hear, for example, at one point, because again, they're sleeping in the forest, they're walking, they don't know what's coming. And Fatima says, I'm sick of this life. And then the young girl says, the 9-year-old girl says, I want to forget everything. And yet, as you said, in addition to that, some of the moments stand out. The family's laughing. They're learning to ride bikes. The mom, Fatima's learning to ride a bike. They're watching fireworks. They're playing in the snow. Fatima and Hassan, the couple, have really interesting conversations about just what are your belief systems? Should our daughter wear a scarf when she gets older? Do you want to wear the scarf? So it's just basic family interactions.
Yeah. And even a fight, which is often people's favorite scene, is like when the parents have a pretty normal fight.
Right. And she says, don't film this, and he still films.
And he still films. And then in the end, she said to me that it's her favorite scene for precisely the reason that she feels it shows that the perception of Afghan women as under the thumb of their husbands and unable to speak for themselves and unable to hold their own opinions is completely wrong.
Yeah.
And we see in this scene because she's actually very articulate and holds her own quite well.
Well, and also when she has to go back to Afghanistan the first time, getting this burqa and saying, what am I supposed to do with this thing? I'm so hot right now. Basically, I don't want to wear this.
Yeah, and I think everyone who's ever seen a woman, you know, wearing that has wondered, isn't she hot under there? And that's in fact exactly what she says.
What was their reaction when they saw the film?
So they were seeing cuts along the way.
Okay.
So they knew what was being made as it was being made. Nonetheless, when they saw it at the Berlinale, which is the only festival they've been able to attend because they don't have passports still, they were thrilled. It was color graded and it was sound mixed and everything was clean and beautiful. And I was a little nervous as the editor. But they were thrilled, and they watched the next day, too.
I don't want to give the film away, but how are they doing now?
They are, well...
I mean, the ending, I should say.
Yeah, well, we started out by talking about how hard the process is when you arrive, and you said particularly for people who are asylum seekers. So they are asylum seekers. They don't have asylum yet, so they're still very much in limbo. And that is an extremely anxious place to live, you know, to live for... at this point, you know, 5 years, not knowing if you can provide safety and stability to your kids. The daughters are at least going to school and going to school in a language where hopefully if they get asylum, that will become, you know, their new home language. Along the route, they got very little schooling. It was spotty and it was in all different languages. Mm.
And we're talking with Emily Madovian about Midnight Traveler. The film chronicles an Afghan family's 3,500-mile, 3-year journey to Europe to flee the Taliban. The parents and their 2 daughters document their journey using cell phones. And you can see the film, if you're in the Bay Area, this afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Creativity Theater in San Francisco, tomorrow night at 5:30 at the Berkeley Art Museum, and it will eventually be on PBS. What about you, Tom? How did Junior, Subby, Cheyenne, and Marie respond when they saw the film?
We just finished the film, like, you know, 2 weeks ago. So nothing like 11th-hour filmmaking, having a deadline of a film festival. So we did a little friends and family cast and crew screening. And I think initially it was, like, really scary for all of us. But, you know, it was the first time that they'd seen the entire cut. And I think they felt, you know, very exposed. But they all had incredible emotions, and they just expressed quite a lot of gratitude to sort of see a kind of 3-year process that had been, you know, pretty formative for them, kind of laid out. And then watching them last night stand up on the stage, it was pretty emotional. Like, each one of them came up, and there was, like, a 5-minute standing ovation for each one of them. And so I think they felt the love from San Franciscans. And what excites me so much, people who, as I said before, who had to keep things so hidden are now going to become the ambassadors of their own stories. And we're really lucky to have gotten some funding from the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation to take the film on the road with these folks so that they can kind of, you know, represent the film themselves around the U.S. and hopefully outside of the U.S. too.
And I also don't want to give the ending away, but how are they all doing?
They're doing well. They're doing well. I mean, they're still struggling, all of them, with the issues of resettlement, but their lives have stabilized. Their ability to begin to connect with interests and hopes and dreams that are beyond some of the issues that we've talked about today are starting to take root, and that's really, really gratifying to see, too.
And Cheyenne and Marie have left the Bay Area, but Subi and Junior are still here.
That's right. That's right, yeah.
And that film is Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America. Tom Shepard is the director and producer of that film. It follows the stories of several LGBT asylum seekers from Africa and the Middle East who are fleeing violent bigotry and hate in their home countries, and in some cases, even from their own families. And if you're in the Bay Area, you can see Unsettled tonight at 8 o'clock at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. It'll also broadcast on PBS eventually, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We've got about a minute left. Final thoughts from both of you about what this experience was like, or, you know, just what you're hoping people take away from these films.
It's Emily? A nice pairing, these two films. I'm hoping that I hope that people watch films like this and then think really deeply about what it is that allows us to sit back and kind of make pronouncements about other people's choices in these extremely difficult circumstances.
Couldn't agree more. Thank you, Rose.
Well, thank you both, Tom Shepard and Emily Madovian. Thank you both so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. I hope you can see these films. You can find more information about the San Francisco International Film Festival at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Thanks to Brianna Martin, our intern, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio, and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.